This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn-Mark Roshan-Kanisen and Noel Lim, with you all the way until 10 o'clock this morning. It is a Monday, the 12th of April. How are we both? How are we all doing?
Are you asking yourself as well?
Yeah, I know. It's a bit of a weird phrasing of that. But, you know, it just means that I'm curious about your weekend.
It's because you're feeling inclusive this morning. That's what's happening.
I am, yes. That's exactly what's happening.
Yeah, the weekend was good. So we're doing like 2 weeks in a row now. So I'm really looking forward to this week, getting some exciting news as usual.
Yeah, actually, I'm gonna shout out the Breakfast Grill that I'm doing this morning with Mark Blythe, co-author of Agronomics. I'm particularly excited for this one because this book is a really interesting one. He and his co-author basically boil down all the issues that we see today down to
the things that make people angry.
Yes, the book is called Agronomics, and basically whether it's demonstrations in Hong Kong or the insurgency we saw in the U.S. earlier this year, all of them have anger in common, and this comes down to wealth and inequality, and they break down the types of anger, but also they've got a few solutions. One of them includes a national wealth fund, which is particularly interesting because Malaysia has wealth funds of its own. So I'm going to talk to him about that, some of the solutions, other solutions like data dividends, things like that. Should be an interesting conversation.
Yes, that's going to happen later on after the 8 o'clock news bulletin. But if you can't catch it, make sure to find the podcast, which will be out later on this morning. In the meantime, though, we're taking a look at what's going to be happening later on at about after the 6:30 news. Noel, what's on the agenda this morning?
I think we will always be looking somewhere close to Malaysia, and that would be Myanmar. The protest is still going on. Some sad news. And also Trump. You remember him? Donald Trump?
Well, who's that?
Yeah, he's in the news again. And something about Amazon, if we have time.
And in about 10, 15 minutes, we'll be taking a look at how are we going to quantify the recovery from the pandemic, right? Because a lot of times we're looking to GDP recovery, but even before the pandemic, we were really starting to question the inclusiveness of the GDP number as a overall barometer of how well society is doing. We continue with those questions in about 10, 15 minutes.
And if you want to weigh in on those conversations, you can WhatsApp us. The number is 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us over at BFM Radio. Up next, though, how to find out a company's culture with a couple of simple questions. Be sure to stay tuned for that. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was the Electric Light Orchestra with Mr. Blue Sky. And you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Roshan and Noel, here to keep you company while we wait for that blue sky to appear, seeing as it's only 6 o'clock in the morning, no sun to be seen just yet. But in the meantime, we're taking a look at an interesting article out of Fast Company. And this is taking aim at, you know, the question that you always get asked at the end of a job interview, when the interviewer looks at you and says, "Great, okay, well, that's about it. Do you have any questions?" And I don't know whether you're the person that says, "No, I don't have any questions," or maybe asks one or two questions about the company, but it's a very crucial time because it is your opportunity to find out more about this company that you presumably are interested in joining. So this article lists 10 questions to ask a hiring manager to really suss out what a company's culture is like without asking straight up, you know, like, "Oh, what's the company actually like?" Because you're not really likely to get a good kind of informative answer, really.
You're going to get a very general answer.
Yeah.
So I prepare students for job interviews, right, at the Asia School of Business. And I always tell them that the questions you ask at the end actually forms part of the interview, because mm-hmm. the interviewer kind of gets a sense of, you know, what you are like as a person. Are you curious? Are you going to ask, you know, those kind of questions like, "How late do you work? What's the bonus like?" Those are very conventional questions, and sometimes it really depends who you're meeting. Those questions may actually not be appropriate at that point in time. I think some of my favourite questions, or I think that is something that is quite crucial to ask, is what are your expectations of success? Like you ask the person who's interviewing you, what do you expect from me, or what do you expect a successful person, mm-hmm. you know, in that job. And then you as a interviewee get a sense whether the employer is actually clear about the the KPIs, the targets, or maybe they are very clear and is there room for negotiation? Because sometimes targets may be quite ridiculous. You know, they may just actually list down a whole list of things and you look at it and you know it's not realistic. And then that's also gives you that room for negotiation to kind of clarify as well. Or maybe the targets are very open and then, you know, then that will be another opportunity to take the conversation to another level.
Yeah, I think one of the key points here is basically don't ask that open-ended generic question where the hiring manager is going to be able to just give you, espouse
the cookie-cutter answer.
The quote-unquote values of the company, right? But also, I just keep in mind the disconnect between the hiring manager and the team leader that you could possibly be working for, right? Because at the end of the day, especially in a bigger company, HR may not necessarily know the ins and outs of the operating structure of your exact team. So you may want, if you're going to ask like specific questions, you may not get a good answer for that. And you've got limited time, right? Let's say you've got 5 minutes left. You want to get something that maybe gives you the company culture overall, as we stated, not exposed to the team culture, but keeping in mind that teams could operate in a more a different kind of environment, right? So I guess from a HR perspective, you have to think about things like, okay, how do you recognize success at the company? These are things that I guess you could ask, and while they do sound fluffy, you kind of get a prioritization of the company's perspective, right? In terms of how they prioritize teams and people, because these are not typical questions, and then maybe they get put on the back foot a little bit and then they feel like they need to give you an answer, and then you're just kind of like
it's how you read between the lines of the answer.
Not getting you won't necessarily get the values and all of that, but you may get some answers in between, right? Because if they can't answer you quickly, or if they it's like game theory, right? It's like you put one question out, you're looking at the non-answers from the answer.
Yeah. So for an example, say, you know, usually if you are looking to join a team, at some point you will have a conversation with the leader of that team. And the question that this article suggests you ask is to ask them about the last person that they recognized for something, right? Because that gives you a bit of an indication as to whether, and it could be anything. It could be a thoughtful conversation. It could be an email. It could be an award or even just a mention at a company-wide meeting, right? You want to see whether that the leader has that mindset to help, you know, to help put other people as well into the spotlight, because that's how you foster a more collegiate atmosphere when that recognition is freely available, right? Of course, in the understanding that it is deserved. I remember a friend of mine once shared the job description as well for something that they encountered on LinkedIn. And it talks about the ideal candidate. And a lot of the times, hiring managers and job descriptions will list, you know, oh, qualifications, you got to have this degree, that degree, you got to have this much experience. But this particular job description also asked for the ideal candidate will have a sense of humor. Right. It didn't have any specifics on, oh, you must have a degree in this field or 7 to 10 years of experience. Just have to have a sense of humor. You have to be able to work in a team. And that was a very interesting example to me of how these descriptions and how conversations with potential hiring managers can give you insight into what that company and that team prioritizes. And then you have a bit more information about whether or not you think you'll be a good fit for them and they for you.
Yeah. So speaking about getting more information, another question that one should not be afraid to ask is whether you can meet someone in the team before accepting the job offer, or maybe the HR person tells you, oh, there's going to be one more final interview, and then there's no harm in asking actually before, if you do call me for a final interview, may I meet someone from the team, because then it might help me prepare. And what this sends, you send a signal that you're proactive, mm-hmm. one, and then two, you are, you know, very engaged in a job and you really are, you know, you are very keen on the job, or, you know, you're very engaged in wanting to, you know, get more information. And actually this kind of conversation towards the end is also, you know, one should not be afraid to sort of, you know, kind of indicate what sort of culture that you think will really work for you. I know it is the employer's market right now. Employees might be afraid to, you know, kind of rock the boat. But, you know, an interview is really a meeting of minds. It's about, you know, you also sussing out whether this is the right place for you.
Yeah, but, you know, sometimes also because of there are certain sectors where they need to hire people quickly. And I've heard, like, horror story interviews where the interview is like 3 minutes long, where they just go in and suss out the person and be like, okay, yeah, fine. When can you start? That sort of situation, right? It's not the, you get no gauge of employee culture. In fact, that 3 minute meeting,
the gauge is fast and quick.
Correct. But also like disorganized, right? Because the person has not even read the CV, things like that. So there are, I mean, this is like ideal situation, but also keep in mind that there are also going to be lots of horrible kinds of interviews processes in
many,
the works
many,
as well.
Many different kinds. But do let us know what kind of questions you ask during a job interview that might, to you, reveal the company's culture. You can WhatsApp us at 01878988899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. We have some messages coming up and then looking at how the pandemic recovery should really be measured. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Little of Your Love by Haim, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Roshan and Noel. So when we talk about GDP a lot on the show, right? And GDP, or gross domestic product, is a very commonly used indicator to signal the economic prosperity of a country. So GDP measures total economic output, from goods and services to trade in monetary terms. And since its inception in the 1930s, GDP per capita, so that is the total GDP of a country divided by its total population, has become also a very common indicator of that country's wealth. But as you know, starting from about 10 years ago, a lot of criticism has started to crop up over whether or not this is a really accurate reflection of the well-being of a population within a given country. So this is an article in Fast Company as well this morning, and it looks at the, it takes a look back at the financial crisis, which is in 2008, which is when researchers first saw the split between a country's GDP per capita and declines in well-being. So this was most apparent in rich countries, because if you're a poor country, then GDP per capita maybe is a pretty reasonable indicator for you to use. But the further up you go in terms of the overall wealth, then you know other factors start to come into play as well. So juxtapose that against the pandemic. How are we going to really measure this pandemic recovery?
So let's just start this off with a bit of a context, right? The GDP measure was only started in the 1930s because we needed a way to measure economies and what to do, right? Essentially, all scores and measures are a way to quantify certain actions. How do we know we're supposed to lose weight? Oh, we use our weight measure. And then eventually we started putting weight aside and said, oh, we need to look at our body fat index, or we need to look at BMI, things like that. Measurements change and can get better over time. Why hasn't the way we take a look at a country's well-being changed over time? It's been almost 100 years and we're still depending on a very crude measure, right? The amount of goods produced by an economy, not even income produced. We're talking about goods mm-hmm. produced by. Now, this is not saying throw the GDP number out the window. It's an important measure for general policy making. A GDP per capita is a rough measure of how wealthy or unwealthy a nation or individuals are. But as we've seen, the gap is rising. So GDP per capita is a false measure of the situation on the ground, because the rich have gotten richer. If Bill Gates enters a bar, everyone automatically becomes a billionaire if we use the GDP per capita measure in that
Absolutely.
Situation.
Because if the top 10%, if only like 10% of the population holds 95% of the country's wealth, then you know that's really going to be a very distorted image of how wealthy the majority of the country actually is.
This conversation is certainly very interesting. GDP is only one measure, and it's a measure of economic prosperity. But as we know, there are many indicators of well-being, for example, the attainment for education standards, spending more time with your families, having more vacation time, for example. Even, you know, whether job opportunities are available, do you have a roof over your head? So some of these are very important indicators too. So you can only improve what you measure, right? And if you're not measuring those indicators and giving them sufficient prominence, policymakers will tend to kind of gloss over this. And so Bhutan has come up with their gross domestic happiness, and I think they've also come up with some quite comprehensive indicators. I think some of the problems, though, would be finding a reliable measure and also collecting the right data to, you know, for example, just asking people, are you happy? That itself, I think, is actually a good question. But, you know, there is so many things that just affect happiness, right? Just because you have more time with your family does not necessarily mean you are that happy because you may be quite limited in your higher education prospects. And so so that's where we are now. But I think it's better to have that conversation rather than not. And it forces policymakers to think more seriously and it also force people to think what actually makes them happy.
Yeah, the thing is, if we don't work towards a new measure, policymakers will continue to play the short-termism game of how do we increase GDP? And the easiest answer is just stimulate big companies and rich people and increase their net worths and your GDP per capita will go up with that. Now, in 2011, the OECD introduced the Better Life Initiative, which ranks all 37 OECD members based on 11 dimensions that contributes to a citizen's well-being, right? So we're talking about job security, education, health, civic engagement, purchasing power, and so on. And so forth. There are 11 of these, but rightly so, it is difficult to quantify these things, which again goes back to our reliance on a GDP number, which again comes down to surveys as well. So how do we mass conduct these kind of surveys and standardize them in a way that gives us a better reflection of on the ground? Because we are not going to get a perfect measure by any means, but getting some data, especially today where data is the new oil, everyone talks about how to monetize data. Why don't we look at ways to optimize data to get these kind of measures, right? But also understand what goes underneath the black box, because you don't also want to have a situation where, again, you're measuring the wrong things just to gamify the system.
I think, well, perfection is, if we don't do anything in the, and just a hope for perfection, then we're really not going to get nowhere at all, right? So the important thing here is to start the journey, to take steps. And if we find that, hey, this factor that we're measuring actually isn't that indicative or doesn't actually correlate very well with a population's overall well-being, then you move on, right? Then you try and think of other factors that you can look at. Is it that the environment around this population is being exploited because you are a developing country and you are deforestation is rampant?
Yeah, most stats departments have median salaries. We have unemployment data. Just trying to correlate all of that, and you will be able to find your own measure, I think, with the abundance of information that we have.
Let us know what you think about this. You know, what should we be really looking at in order to suss out the pandemic recovery? You can WhatsApp us at 01878988999, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. We're heading into the 6:30 news, and to take you there is Paul McCartney with Another Day, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was hard to explain by the Strokes. And you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kunnison and Noel Lim. Now, at about this time every morning, we take a look at what's what's caught our eye on the international stage. And of course, our attention has turned to details coming out of Myanmar. It has been just over, I believe, 70 days since Myanmar saw a military coup in the country, and unrest has persisted since then. We have news that Myanmar security forces fired rifle grenades at protesters in a town near Yangon on Friday. So a monitoring group have said that they killed more than 80 people. So details of the death tolls, I think, were not initially available. But these monitoring groups have managed to speak with some witnesses as well as domestic media outlets.
There are some variations in the numbers reported. So just looking at some news sites, it says more than 600 people. And this is according to sources from activist groups.
Yeah, in total.
Yes, in total. But the government, I think the junta, claims there are only about 250 people that were killed. Well, either way, the numbers are in the hundreds, right? And it seems so unnecessary. And also some of the latest news is that 19 people have been sent to death for killing an associate of an army captain, according to, I think, some latest news on Friday. So these are first of such sentences that were announced. I think the point here is that ousted Myanmar lawmakers are urging the United Nations Security Council to take action against the military. And so, they are urging the council members to apply both direct and indirect pressure on the junta. And according to Richard Horsey, a senior advisor on Myanmar with the International Crisis Group, says that Myanmar stands at the brink of state failure or state collapse.
Moving on to another story we've got in the international front. Former President Donald Trump has vowed, apparently, to help Republicans win seats in Congress in 2022, the election then, but lashed out at the two top party figures. That's Senate Minority Leader, it feels good to say that, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, and former Vice President Mike Pence, and this was at a donor retreat on Saturday. And this was, I think, a dinner at his Mar-a-Lago club for Republican National Committee donors in Florida. And he made it clear he's still irked at his inability to hang on to the White House.
And he's blaming everyone else for it but himself.
Oh, man, that's just him. Yeah, blame everyone but himself for his own loss. This is the complete opposite of what to learn from a leader, right? This is the complete opposite of Leadership 101.
Yes. So before leaving office, if we remember, Mitch McConnell drew Donald Trump's ire after he stated...
It's McConnell's fault, the it's obvious. Pence's fault.
And this is because he stated the obvious that Joe Biden had won the presidency. And of course, Trump also took aim at Mike Pence for, I believe it was not intervening to stop the congressional certification of the vote tally. And this is despite the fact that this is an authority that the vice president doesn't have.
In prepared remarks seen by Reuters, Trump is seeking to position himself as the Republican kingmaker, saying he wanted to talk about the future of the Republican Party and what they must do to set their candidates on course to victory. And so I think the million-dollar question or billion-dollar question, is he going to run for presidency again?
I think it'd be more dangerous if he didn't, because if he's going to go to ground and support congressional seats, that might be a dangerous move for the Democrats, because don't forget, yes, they won the presidency, but they lost seats in Congress. They reduced their majority in the House because of and a lot of central seats that they lost. What happens if you start seeing Trump saying, okay, I don't have to worry about my own campaigning, but let me go campaign for my supporters, which he does have in Congress and the House. Those he endorsed did win seats. So what happens in that situation? It becomes a much more spread out fight. And Donald Trump is very good at spreading out and going all over the place and galvanizing the troops. So he's very good at that. He's a good marketer. So this is something I think the Democrats need to be a bit wary of.
Yeah, so he certainly commands a lot of influence still, because CNN reported this new Reuters Ipsos poll found that 55% of Republicans still believe that Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 presidential election was the result of illegal voting. Additionally, 60% of Republicans also agree that the election was stolen from Trump.
Yeah, let's not forget that 74 million people did vote for Donald Trump. Because he was not impeached, though they attempted to do so for the second time immediately after as he was leaving office, it means that he can run again. And I mean, judging by looking at Donald Trump's, how he's positioned himself over the course of his 4 years as president and the acrimonious way he left the White House, I do suspect that he will run again. So that'll be an exciting next election.
He left the White House during the inauguration. But very quickly, India says it has become the fastest country in the world to administer more than 100 million doses of the coronavirus vaccine amid a deadly second wave. It achieved the feat in 85 days, whereas the US took 89 and China 102. That said, though, the country reported a record daily increase of 150,000 cases and more than 800 new deaths on Sunday.
Yes, so certainly a situation that we will be watching as vaccines also roll out around the world. But right now, we're about to head into some messages, and then after that, we're taking a look at our own local papers and portals. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Coffee and TV by Blue, and we're adding on radio to your morning because you're listening to us here on The Morning Run. Lynn, Roshan and Noel here with you. And we're taking a look at the front pages of our newspapers and portals this morning on the local front. What do we have in the NST, Noel?
So on the front page of the New Straits Times, it's about Kelantan, and the big headlines here, Kelantan is critical with the state's R not at 1.12. This is, we're talking about COVID. Kelantan is cancelling the Tarawih prayers and also Ramadan bazaars. I think it pays to be safe, right? So and so that's the kind of concrete actions that they're taking. And as we know, in terms of vaccinations, a total of 571,000 have already received the first dose. And of that number, 385,000 have received two doses. And so, well, I'm not sure if this is whether we should be accelerating our vaccination program. But when I look at some of the curve charts of, other countries that have been vaccinated, it almost feels like at one point it will start to really accelerate. And hopefully that will be the situation for Malaysia.
And Roshan, you have the Malaysian Reserve. What's caught your eye in that paper?
Well, what's caught my eye is Tun Dr. Mahathir was on the front page. And it's basically a piece on FDI, and the headline reads, Dr. M, time for Malaysia to shift strategy, stop relying on FDI. The sentiment here, long story short, is basically his concern over the reliance on FDI being one thing, but also that we need to work on the domestic front. How do we build automation, higher value jobs domestically on our own? Because when it comes to FDI, and I think this is something that's also a viewpoint shared by many people, it's a beauty contest largely. And when we look at the competitive scene across the region is quite tight. And essentially, it becomes a race to the bottom, right? Mm. Oh, I can give you tax incentives for 10 years. I'll give you tax incentives for 20 years. You know, that's sort of the situation. Because what happens is that after the 10 years, like the company will only invest here if they see that return, right? And then after 10 years, they might just move on to another country that's offering them a better deal. But that said, though, you can't just throw the baby out with the bathwater in this situation, because we do still want these MNCs to come and invest here and build up the talent pool and things like that. But I guess also just keep in mind that FDI isn't like the GDP. It's another three-number acronym that doesn't solve everything, right? Just increasing FDI isn't the be-all and all of how we're going to boost the economy. Really, things like education factors. If you can build a talented workforce, then people will come to you eventually. Because Singapore is not the cheapest place to run a company, but people still set up their regional offices in Singapore.
Clarity is also very important.
Government policy.
When we are talking about when we're talking about bolstering business confidence in order to rebuild the economy, and there appears to have been somewhat of a lack of clarity when it comes to foreigners who came in on social visit passes, but have since had their social visit passes expire because they were caught by the movement control order. So that is what's on the front page of the Star. The headline here is "Caught in Limbo," because apparently, starting last week, some foreigners in the country began receiving emails from their embassies advising them that they may have to leave the country before April 21st, so in 9 days, if they have a social visit pass that expired on or after January 1st, 2020. So this is there's been a bit of confusion because I believe originally the government said that there would be a 14 working day grace period for foreigners to leave after the end of the MCO on March 31st of this year. But we do know that, you know, we're still under CMCO, so that's expected to continue at least until April 14th. So, but it appears that the grace period has not been extended for these foreigners. So a lot of them are questioning why this is the case.
Yeah, so indeed, it can be quite traumatic, you know, making all these arrangements to go home. And what about your job if you have one here? So just very quickly, so some strict SOPs at Ramadan bazaars. As we know, with the fasting month, it's going to start tomorrow, fasting. Preparations for Ramadan bazaars have also started in earnest. Last year, we know that they were not allowed to operate. So this year, they will be allowed to under strict conditions. So 65 bazaars have been allowed to operate starting from tomorrow. So I just wanted to wish Muslims happy fasting.
On the political front, I just want to quickly shout out the fact that Seremban MP Anthony Loke has emerged with the highest number of votes in the Negeri Sembilan DAP election. He garnered 501 votes from the delegates. Basically, in that situation, you've got the top 15 candidates will then, I guess, divvy up the leadership posts amongst themselves. But I bring this up also because I know I've heard on the ground sentiments of how there are some who would like to see Anthony Loke lead DAP in the next election because he's got less baggage than Lim Guan Eng or Lim Kit Siang. And no disrespect to either one of them, but I think we need fresh faces at the top of all these big major parties, UMNO as well. All these different parties need new faces to lead them into a new generation, because same faces have been at the top for a very, very, very long time. It would be nice to see that. And I echo sentiments from our conversation with Warisan President last week, Dr. Sri Shafi Abdal, who also in a way talked about this. And he himself is, even though 60 years old or thereabouts, he is also a fresh face in terms of prime ministerial candidates, or possibly, he didn't confirm or deny, but he is talking to Muda. There's a lot of youthfulness coming through, or new faces, and hopefully we start seeing less people with baggage run for office and things like that.
Yes, indeed. I think we are a little bit overdue for a refresh in our political landscape. Right now, we're about to head into the 7 o'clock news bulletin, though, and then after that, more business news and analysis. But for some music, I'll Feel a Whole Lot Better by The Birds, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.